Talk given Sunday, 15th September 1974, at the Muller House, Elmau. If our meeting here this evening is to be a true communion, we must listen, we must look with a completely open mind. It is very difficult to do this because it is not easy to avoid interpreting what we hear according to our own previous ideas and conditioning. Moreover, whilst we are listening, we are always bringing our own values, our judgments, our past experience and knowledge to bear upon what is put before us. Therefore, we do not listen with a totally sensitive and a totally open mind. However, we must try. And then we may discover that something has been communicated right from the depths of the speaker into the deeps of the souls of those who listen. When that happens, something comes to fruition which never does in the ordinary way, when our intellectual judgments are uppermost all the time. Let us then consider first what has been the condition of man through the ages. What is his condition today? Through the ages, man has struggled for survival. He has known great hardship, great misery, starvation, constant fear, anxiety, war. And this has happened in accord with the law of his survival, his physical survival. And this law of survival is the law of the jungle. It is the law in accordance with which man lives, acts, thinks, and feels, entirely related to himself. He is the center of his consciousness. He is not awake to something which is a greater whole and to his relationship with that whole. So, man has lived enclosed in his isolated self-consciousness, struggling for personal survival, drawing the world unto himself all the time. And so, the story of man through the ages has been marked with sorrow, marked with frustration, as far as he himself within his own inner depths is concerned. But what is the condition of man today? Is it much different? It is true that because of his science, his knowledge, his experience, he has used these machines, He has found out ways and means of organization, social organization, political organization, and so on, by which he has some achievements, as he calls them, to his credit. But in spite of all these achievements, can we say that man is free from fear, from anxiety? Is he free from the confusion in his mind as to the meaning of life, the purpose of existence? Can we say that he is free from wars, the constant threat of wars? There is always the shadow of imminent destruction over us all through our existence. We say we have learnt the lessons of history, but have we? And if we have learnt some lessons, are they not the lessons of mere cunning, of mere diplomacy? And at the back of all that cunning and diplomacy lies the same self-centeredness, this groping in ignorance of the meaning of life, the way of its fulfillment, and above all, his servitude to self. Is that not the fact of our existence today, just as it was centuries ago, thousands of years ago, tens of thousands of years ago? And if we look carefully into the forces which have operated in his own soul, which have been the drive from within him, we will see that they are greed, pleasure lust, violence, self-assertion, the passion for power and for dominating others, and so on. All this has been the result of his animal origin, the primordial ancestor, the animal from which he has evolved, coupled with, in the case of man, the development of his intellect, especially through the changes made in the structure of his body by natural evolution. The development of his brain has outrun the development of other sensitivities, such as his moral sensitivity and his spiritual sensitivity, and, I may add, a true social sensitivity. He hasn't got these developed yet, because as the brain outran his development, these other aspects of his being used his intellect in the service of his desire, his passions. Which means he used his intellect in order to assert his ignorant outlook on life, his misunderstanding of the nature of this particular animal, himself, man, who is so remarkably different from all other animal species. This is what he has never looked into, even up till today. How and why is it that the intellect has become the slave of desire, of unintelligent, blind desire? And yet, there is that in his nature which is transcendence embodied. It is the spark of the divine, a spark that never dies and can come to fruition and make him understand individually what it means to be a human being. Through the ages, mankind has not had vision. And you know the good old saying, where there is no vision, the people perish. This is precisely what has happened to the people as a whole. But there have always been the few, those few who somehow or other became awake to transcendence, to something which was beyond them at first. And therefore transcendence was held in awe, and the reverence and worship which man gave to transcendence, to God, call it what you will, was born of a certain degree of fear, till at last the time came when man's development became such that it broke through the narrow bounds of his self-centered, self-enclosed consciousness and realized unity in mind and consciousness with the totality of nature and of the transcendent energy, the transcendent power which lay beyond the senses, which lay beyond the brain and all his intellectual processes. So those few understood. They saw the meaning of life, and they taught man what was the meaning of man and what were his possibilities. They were men of vision. We have been accustomed, because of our history books and various other sources and various other reasons, to regard perhaps the great conquerors and the great pirates as men of vision, people who exploited nature, exploited land, exploited other people, made themselves or their families or their communities great, as they called it. But can the vision of the worldling, the man of the world, confined to the world, be called true vision? If that is true vision, then vision is always going to lead us into misery, sorrow, unfulfillment, and frustration. But this vision has a deeper meaning, a meaning which comes into flower when one has the capacity for becoming unselfed, transcending the limitations of self, and allowing the total reality to flood his being and come to fruition there, in his very body, which is the temple of God. I want to digress a little here. Into this beautiful valley of Elmau, some 60 years ago, there came a man, Johannes Müller. He saw this valley, and in his inner being, he became one with it. He understood what this valley meant And understanding what this valley meant, he understood what all nature meant. And he had it in his nature, in his own being, to break through the bondages which hold most of us. And he had the vision. He was a man of vision. You may ask me, on what grounds do you make such statements? Because I, who say these things, do not know German, and I have not read any of his works, except one, in English, Jesus as I See Him. When I read Jesus as I See Him, I too saw Jesus through the eyes of Johannes Müller, not the eyes of the flesh which are closed forever now, but through those sleepless, immortal eyes of the Spirit which shine in everyone's darkness. And I knew here was a man of vision. As I walked through these beautiful meadows and woodlands, and look at the hills, when I touch the stone, the solid rock, and listen to the stream as it goes past, see the wonderful eyes, the sunlight shining through the leaves, I see everywhere the spirit of Johannes Müller, reflecting in beauty and truth, the spirit that is the eternal spirit, the invisible spirit. The sun gives warmth to the earth. It gives life to the whole earth and everything on it. And it gives light to all. And I always feel, every time I am here, that Johannes Müller gave warmth, life, and light. The warmth of love, the life of creativeness, and the light of wisdom. Now, perhaps, we might begin to see something of what it means to be a human being. Walk round here and look. But look with the mind utterly open, with your heart still and silent, and you will see, or at least I have seen, and I see it every time I am here, these great mountains speaking of the power of truth, of reality, in their concretest form. These great peaks which tower up and seem to the eyes of the flesh that they end there, in fact do not end there. From each of these peaks there stream upwards great rivers of light. I am speaking metaphorically. Great rivers of light which reach up to the zenith above us, the sky itself. And the sky has no limits. There is infinity there. There is a plenitude and a mystery and a marvel and a wonder and a beauty that is completely beyond the man who is self-enclosed within his little outlook. And this is the possibility that lies within each and every one of us, to wake up to this. And when we wake up to it, what is happening? The law of the jungle is laid to rest, and this animal organism begins to come to a state of peace, and the law of the spirit begins to operate. And what is the meaning of the law of the spirit? How does it actually function in our everyday life? Otherwise it will remain merely a poetic phrase. What is its real meaning? As I said earlier, the law of the jungle is the law by which each one of us draws the world unto himself. But the law of the spirit is such that I wake up to the fact that whatsoever I draw unto myself, or need to draw unto myself, must be so drawn that it flows freely through me, through myself back again to the world, enriched, a blessing and a benediction on everything around me, which means that I am unselfed. Here is the marvel. The infinite self functions through the finite self. That which is transcendent, unlimited, functions through that which is mortal. And it is in this way that man will find his true fulfillment. What happens then to those forces which were operating while he was still confined to his animal state in mind and consciousness? To the forces of greed, violence, fear, confusion, delusion, ignorance, and so on. What happens to all these? They begin to disappear. One may ask, how is it that they disappear? Because they are my heritage, through my animal descent, through my course of natural evolution, they are my heritage. How do they disappear? All these forces are psychical energies. Psychical energy by itself has no quality, good or bad. It is just pure energy, like electricity or heat or any other energy. It is the way we use it. It is the way it functions in you that makes it a virtue or a vice. If it is ill expressed, then it is a vice. It brings sorrow. It brings ill health. It brings frustration. But if it functions in an harmonious way, it is on the road of virtue. I only say the road of virtue at present. Therefore, one must exercise perpetual mindfulness. We are conscious, we are awake. Let us be wholly mindful of every thought and feeling, every word we speak, of every action we perform. See it for what it actually is, undiluted, and see it dispassionately. That is to say, we must not react against it if it is something we don't like or which we disapprove of. Nor must we get attached to it if we think it is good. Because both these are bondages, and both these aspects, aversion and attachment, prevent pure understanding, prevent the functioning of perfect intelligence. Intelligence is the power in us which sees the truth of things as they are. But intelligence is hindered by our likes and our dislikes, by our taking sides with this against that, by our attachment and our aversion. Intelligence is hindered. Intellect, cunning, may function, but not intelligence. Pure intelligence functions where there is pure mindfulness. You remember the words of Jesus, "Watch and pray." Very important word, watch, because by this watchfulness, this mindfulness, this liberation of intelligence into action, there grows understanding within us. Now, in the context of true humanity, not subhumanity which has existed throughout the ages all over the earth, in the context of true humanity, understanding is wise love. It is loving wisdom. That is the real meaning of understanding. It is a power which unites you with everything that you experience, whether psychically, intellectually, transcendentally, or physically. So this understanding grows, and then the compassionate heart is matured. Then the mind itself begins to come to maturity within us. When this happens, then at last we are free from our subhuman state and we enter the truly human state. What will happen under such circumstances? Will a true human being manifest greed? Will he manifest violence? Will he be afraid of anything? Will he be eaten up with anxiety, sorrow, misery? Above all, will he ever be a source of suffering to his environment and everyone around him, and every animal around him? So we begin to see what it means to be a human. But this is still at the psychological, at a personal level, the psyche in us. Our aesthetic sensitivities, all these are involved. But there is something even more than that. We have used the term human. Have we ever tried to understand? Have we ever really penetrated into the full marvel and splendor, the awesomeness of the meaning of the word human? look at its derivation. It comes from the Sanskrit hu, hu, and man. Hu man. Hu is interchangeable with su, su. Su or hu in Sanskrit means happy. Not happy in the sense of mere pleasure, mere excitement, mere fun or satisfaction of desire. Nothing to do with that. It means the happy one whose happiness never alters, who is, in fact, in the state of bliss. As we say in India, ananda. Or if you like the Christian phrase, the peace of God which passeth understanding. This is the happy state. And the word man, if you look in the dictionary, you will read the word to think. But here we must be careful. The dictionary has no option but to use the word to think. And immediately we say, oh yes, I must think. But be careful. What is our thinking process? It is just an endless chatter, is it not? And when I say, oh, I must think about it, what am I doing? I am talking in my mind. My speech faculty is active all the time. It never stops. Again, Jesus' words, watch and pray. What will you watch? The cars going from Kleist to Munich, one after the other? Well, you have to watch that if you are driving yourself. But what was Jesus referring to when he said, watch and pray? Watch here, your thought process. What goes through here non-stop in the brain? And if we watch for even 2 minutes, we will feel just a little bit ashamed of ourselves, because the entire conversation that runs through here is round the word I. Ich. This ich, this little line, fills the whole universe. Consider how we are self-conscious, I and the world. This immense universe is just the other factor. And of these two factors, I and the world, I is always the greater one. Must be, because I always occupies my mind, not the world. Isn't that so? And this separation of I and the world is the basic duality, which is the root of all conflict between self and not self. And therefore, we are always under the law of the jungle. So this is our ordinary thinking. It is self-concerned. But now look. there is another meaning to that root sound in Sanskrit, man. The verb is manyate, which is derived from man. But man means really the thought which is creative power. And you cannot separate the creative power in this transcendental sense from the eternal creative action. We can store up electricity as an energy and say, well, we have stored it up and we can do something with it afterwards. But in terms of this living creative power, there is no storing up. It is perpetual creative action. Creative action in eternity. Now, thought, the thought in the mind of God is the conception which is formed through this creative action in eternity. And this is the root meaning of the word man. And God thought, or God minded so and so, and immediately so and so was. It has been translated into English in the first chapter of Genesis, and God said, let there be light. But instead of translating it as said, if we translate it as God minded, this mind power, this transcendental mind power, and there was light, we will see what is the meaning of the word mind. Now you and I, we are human. Hu manas, the happy creator. But this is a description of God. God who lives beyond the stars, as they say, in everlasting bliss, and who is the creator of all things, is the supreme meaning of that word in our language, human. So we begin to see now the transcendental aspect of what it means to be human, to be the happy creator, everlastingly in creative action. And we might naturally think, ah, the great artists, the great scientists maybe, and so forth, the great musicians, poets, sculptors, and so forth, the philanthropists who have great ideas, great charity, and so forth. Yes, that is part of creation. But think carefully. Be as attentive as possible. All this which we do on earth is procreation. It is related to something within us, within other people. It is related to that which is already known and which has a continuity in this world, which is the world of mortality and death. All these creations may come into being. They live so long and then dissolve. You know the works of Homer and Dante and Goethe and Shakespeare and so on. You know the compositions of Bach and Beethoven and Brahms and so on. You know the work of Michelangelo and others and all the rest of it, which we call creation. But they came into being, they presented the picture of this eternal beauty which is beyond all pictures. And they will live so long, and then they will pass away, they will die. Who will remember Beethoven 25,000 years hence? Just as we now know nothing about who were the creators 25,000 years ago. So I say, this is procreation. It comes out of us, it is a mortal expression, although it is an expression so wonderful that we are stimulated, we are inspired to the vision and the sense, the feeling for immortality. But within ourselves there is the possibility of immortal creation. That is the transcendental aspect of what it means to be a human. This immortal creation has no shape, no form, no words, no pictures, no sound. What am I talking about, you will say then? Supreme within us is the power of communion. I mentioned love and wisdom. Loving wisdom, wise love, is understanding. You remember? Now, the supreme communion which the great mystics of the world realized, the great founders of the world's religions, this supreme communion is such that oneself becomes so still, so silent, and so transcends all states of ordinary discriminative consciousness that he merges into a transcendent awareness being in complete unity with the total reality. You may name it simply God if you like. Or if you like, you may use Eckhart's word, which goes beyond the word God, Gottheit. Or you may use the word which Dionysius the Areopagite used, the superessential reality. The mystics used phrases like the divine dark, the abyss, and so forth, because they had no words to express this thing. They used such phrases. Now, when we go completely beyond our discriminative consciousness state and are in that supreme communion, then we are in rhythm with that creative pulse of the universe, the pulse of creation, the activity of God, that activity which takes place in eternity transcendentally, because of which there are signs, signatures, if you like, of the divine scattered through the great void which is space. And if you are in tune, if you are in rhythm with that pulse, then you know what creation means. You don't know it with the brain. You know it with your power of unknowing. Be very careful, these are not mere words. They represent the transcendent reality. You know with your power of unknowing, that is to say, with that power of non-discriminative consciousness, the consciousness which does not analyze, but with your power of being that which you are, you become that of which you are aware. Now the great scholars have unfortunately been a bit mistaken when they have examined the words and writings of the great mystics of the world, and they have said that this just represents a vacuous state of mind. It is nothing of the sort. It is the supreme reality that is possible to the human. In this state, he is one with God, creating. Do you know the meaning of the word Israel? The meaning of the word Israelite? Who is an Israelite? He is one who rules with God. That is one of its meanings. That is an Israelite who rules with God. But how does God rule? By force? By anything that we know? No. He rules because God is total awareness, being, bliss, all three simultaneously. We have to use these words. It is difficult to escape our limitations when, at the level of our senses and the discursive mind functioning through our brain, we have to communicate with each other. So, the sort of words I can use are awareness, being, bliss, all three simultaneously. And this is the state in which you are creating with God in eternity. I believe Johannes Müller saw this signature of transcendence throughout everything. I mentioned some time ago the sun which gives warmth, life, and light. Each one of us humans, like that sun which shines in the heavens, can give warmth of love, life, which is creativeness, and light, which is wisdom. And something which goes right beyond this too. Just as the sun which remains in the heavens, a sign of transcendence, each one of us here in this world is also a sign of transcendence. But there is a difference. Our supreme expression is when the sign has disappeared, when I am no more, and then there is only God, the fulfilled supreme meaning of the word human.